responsible and said, "Thank you very much indeed. That's out of the question." "Why?" said the old man with both fists on the table. "Because it is quite out of the question. Thank you."
"You see, we don't like to take..."
began Lucy. Her cousin again repressed her.
"But why?" he persisted. "Women like looking at a view, men don't."
And he thumped with his fists like a naughty child and turned to his son, saying, "George, persuade them." "It's so obvious they should have the rooms," said the son. "There's nothing else to say." He did not look at the ladies as he spoke, but his voice was perplexed and sorrowful. Lucy, too, was perplexed, but she saw that they were in for what is known as quite a scene, and she had an odd feeling that whenever these ill-bred tourists spoke, the contest widened and deepened till it dealt not with rooms and views, but with, well, with something quite different whose existence she had not realized before. Now the old man attacked Miss Bartlett almost violently. Why should she not change? What possible objection had she? They would clear out in half an hour. Miss Bartlett, though skilled in the delicacies of conversation, was powerless in the presence of brutality. It was impossible to snub anyone so gross. Her face reddened with displeasure. She looked around as much as to say, "Are you all like this?" And two little old ladies who were sitting further up the table with shawls hanging over the backs of the chairs looked back, clearly indicating, "We are not, we are genteel." "Eat your dinner, dear," she said to Lucy, and began to toy again with the meat that she had once censured. Lucy mumbled that those seemed very odd people opposite. "Eat your dinner, dear. This pension is a failure. Tomorrow we'll make a change." Hardly had she announced this fell decision when she reversed it. The curtains at the end of the room parted and revealed a clergyman, stout but attractive, who hurried forward to take his place at the table, cheerfully apologizing for his lateness. Lucy, who had not yet acquired decency, at once rose to her feet, exclaiming,
Oh, why, it's Mr. Beebe. Oh, how perfectly lovely. Oh, Charlotte, we must stop now, however bad the rooms are. Oh!
Miss Bartlett said with more restraint, "How do you do, Mr. Beebe? I expect that you've forgotten us, Miss Bartlett and Miss Honeychurch, who were at Tunbridge Wells when you helped the Vicar of St. Peter's that very cold Easter." The clergyman, who had the air of one on a holiday, did not remember the ladies quite as clearly as they remembered him, but he came forward pleasantly enough and accepted the chair into which he was beckoned by Lucy.
"I am so glad to see you,"
said the girl, who was in a state of spiritual starvation, and would have been glad to see the waiter, if her cousin had permitted it.
"Just fancy how small the world is. Summer Street, too, makes it so specially funny."
"Miss Honeychurch lives in the parish of Summer Street,"
said Miss Bartlett, filling up the gap.
"And she happened to tell me in the course of conversation that you've just accepted the living."
"Yes, I heard from Mother so last week. She didn't know that I knew you at Tunbridge Wells. But I wrote back at once, and I said, 'Mr. Beebe is—'"
"Quite right," said the clergyman. "I move into the rectory at Summer Street next June. I'm lucky to be appointed to such a charming neighbourhood."
"Oh, how glad I am. The name of our house is Windy Corner."
Mr. Beebe bowed.
"There's Mother and me, generally, and my brother, though it's not often we get him to church. The church is rather far off, I mean. Lucy, dearest, let Mr. Beebe eat his dinner."
"I am eating it, thank you, and enjoying it."
He preferred to talk to Lucy, whose playing he remembered, rather than to Miss Bartlett, who probably remembered his sermons. He asked the girl whether she knew Florence well, and was informed at some length that she had never been there before. It is delightful to advise a newcomer, and he was first in the field.
"Don't neglect the country round," his advice concluded. "The first fine afternoon, drive up to Fiesole, and round by Settignano, or something of that sort."
"No," cried a voice from the top of the table. "Mr. Beebe, you're wrong. The first fine afternoon, your ladies must go to Prato."
"That lady looks so clever,"
whispered Miss Bartlett to her cousin.
"We're in luck."
And indeed a perfect torrent of information burst on them. People told them what to see, when to see it, how to stop the electric trams, how to get rid of the beggars, how much to give for a vellum blotter, how much the place would grow upon them. The Pension Bertolini had decided, almost enthusiastically, that they would do. whichever way they looked. Kind ladies smiled and shouted at them. And above all rose the voice of the clever lady, crying, "Prato! They must go to Prato! That place is too sweetly squalid for words. I love it. I revel in shaking off the trammels of respectability, as you know." The young man named George glanced at the clever lady and then returned moodily to his plate. Obviously he and his father did not do. Lucy, in the midst of her success, found time to wish they did. It gave her no extra pleasure that anyone should be left in the cold, and when she rose to go, she turned back and gave the two outsiders a nervous little bow. The father did not see it. The son acknowledged it, not by another bow, but by raising his eyebrows and smiling. He seemed to be smiling across something. She hastened after her cousin, who had already disappeared through the curtains, curtains which smote one in the face and seemed heavy with more than cloth. Beyond them stood the unreliable signora, bowing good evening to her guests and supported by Enery, her little boy, and Victoria, her daughter. It made a curious little scene, this attempt of the Cockney to convey the grace and geniality of the South. And even more curious was the drawing-room, which attempted to rival the solid comfort of a Bloomsbury boarding-house. Was this really Italy? Miss Bartlett was already seated on a tightly stuffed armchair, which had the colour and the contours of a tomato. She was talking to Mr. Beebe, and as she spoke, her long, narrow head drove backwards and forwards, slowly, regularly, as though she were demolishing some invisible obstacle. "I am most grateful to you," she was saying. "The first evening means so much. When you arrived here, we were in for a peculiarly mauvais quart d'heure." He expressed his regret. "Do you know, by any chance, the name of an old man who sat opposite us at dinner?" "Emerson. Is he a friend of yours?" "We are friendly, as one is in pensions." "Then I will say no more." He pressed her very slightly, and she said more. "I am, as it were," she concluded, "the chaperone of my young cousin Lucy, and it would be a serious thing if I put her under an obligation to people of whom we know nothing. His manner was somewhat unfortunate. I hope I acted for the best." "You acted very naturally," said he. He seemed thoughtful, and after a few moments added, "All the same, I don't think much harm would have come of accepting." "No harm, of course, but we could not be under an obligation." "He is rather a peculiar man." Again he hesitated, and then said gently, "I think he would not take advantage of your acceptance, nor expect you to show gratitude. He has the merit, if it is one, of saying exactly what he means. He has rooms he does not value, and he thinks you would value them. He no more thought of putting you under an obligation than he thought of being polite. It is so difficult, at least I find it difficult, to understand people who speak the truth." Lucy was pleased and said, "I was hoping that he was nice. I do so always hope that people will be nice." "I think he is nice and tiresome. I differ from him on almost every point of any importance, and so I expect, I may say I hope, you will differ. But his is a type one disagrees with rather than deplores. When he first came here, he not unnaturally put people's backs up. He has no tact and no manners. I don't mean by that that he has bad manners. And he will not keep his opinions to himself. We nearly complained about him to our depressing signora, but I'm glad to say we thought better of it." "Am I to conclude," said Miss Bartlett, "that he is a socialist?" Mr. Beebe accepted the convenient word, not without a slight twitching of the lips. "And presumably he's brought up his son to be a socialist, too. I hardly know George, for he hasn't learnt to talk yet. He seems a nice creature, and I think he has brains. Of course, he has all his father's mannerisms, and it is quite possible that he, too, may be a socialist." "Oh, you relieve me," said Miss Bartlett. "So you think I ought to have accepted their offer? You feel I've been narrow-minded and suspicious?"
"Not at all," he answered. "I never suggested that.
But ought I not to apologize at all events for my apparent rudeness?"
He replied with some irritation that it would be quite unnecessary, and got up from his seat to go to the smoke.